Hi everyone, this is Chris DC, and it was such a pleasure to catch up with Kate Fox for my latest nostalgia interview. Kate is a poet, performer, academic and ethnographer. She often appears on Radio 4. She talks about doing her last gig before lockdown. She talks about her work with the autism and the arts festivals at the University of Kent. We learn about her PhD at Leeds. We talk about conference food. We talk about her experience of lockdown and what has changed her. She talks about recording an episode of Radio 4's Pick of the Week from her living room via her phone. We learn about her book on Northern women and how COVID has given us a new chance to do things differently in this new hybrid world. We talk about issues around accessibility, how things have changed since the 90s in terms of the way universities deal with disability and neurodiversity. She comes from a working class background. Her mother ran a steeplejack business. She had to prove why she needed to go to university in order to become a journalist. And she talks about the advice that she received from Ian Hislop. We talk about whether there is room for the carnivalesque in academia. She talks about the countercultural nature of comedy studies. Leonard Cohen, the cultural omnivore that she was in liking Clueless and Schindler's List. She talks about her experience of working for commercial local radio, why her northern accent was a barrier to reading the news. She talks about why some people are nostalgic for the idea of a strong northern woman, and talks about what her younger self would think about what she has done now. And I ask Kate at the end of the interview if she considers herself to be a trailblazer, and we learn why she is totally stuck in the 1980s. It was so good to catch up with Kate Fox for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris DC. Well, it is such a pleasure to have Kate Fox. And Kate, we were just saying before we started the interview that you were the last person I saw give a talk in the flesh, as it were, before lockdown, when you came down to Kent to give a talk on poetry and stand-up. It must have been, we were just saying, about February of 2020.
Yeah, and I remember that day very clearly. And there's something, quite a few people have been posting on Facebook about gigs that I did in that February and March, and they were their last gig or their last night out. And that how surreal is that in terms of nostalgia for something I did to be this occasion? Because I was out and about a heck of a lot last February and March, which is probably why I ended up with COVID at some point quite early on in the pandemic, I should think. Not that I was ever officially tested, but there we are. But yes, here is to more live events.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, well, I'm sorry to hear about the COVID, because you're right, because I've been doing everything I could, even though I've been sort of out and about, inverted commas, all within the rules, of course. I've managed to go this far without catching it. And so therefore, I've actually been more inclined to stay in the last few months, unlike at the beginning, because I'm thinking, you know, the vaccine is in sight. The last thing I want to do now is put myself or family members at risk. But it has completely, we were just talking about lattes, but completely changed the way in which the things we take for granted are able to happen. And I know lattes are a big thing for you as well.
They are a huge thing. And I know we shared over Facebook, didn't we, last year, the sheer joy, happiness and relief at being able to go out to take away. In fact, if I remember rightly, because I live by the sea in Whitley Bay in the northeast, and a few cafes started opening up, I think mid-May. And at that point, you had not yet had a latte. And I remember saying to you, if you go online, Chris, you'll be able to see, you know, local places might be delivering, and they will probably, some of them will do a latte. Because I knew exactly the feeling you had of the deprivation of it. And I remembered the relief and the joy. Oh my God, to not only specifically a latte, which you can't make in your own house in the same way, you just can't, can you? Yeah. But something that you had not made yourself in your own kitchen. Yeah. Oh, yeah. The joy, the joy.
Well, I have to confess, I queued an hour and a half, no exaggeration. It took me about an hour to get there, and then queued an hour and a half at the one McDonald's in Kent that was doing coffees, and indeed was open at all, with a limited menu, about May last year. So it was about two, three months into lockdown. And of course, everyone else had the same idea. So Saturday afternoon, it was Pick of the Pops on the radio. I can even remember the year, Pick of the Pop, 1997, if you want to ask. And we're sitting there for the whole hour waiting for the McDonald's. And of course, and thankfully, they had the order. Then we did the same thing the following week, thinking, I've waited this long for a lot. I'm not going to go another 3 months. Got there and they said, oh, I'm sorry, we're out of hot drinks.
No. So
had like a Fanta. And I thought, I'm sorry, that's like almost like blasphemous.
Exactly. That must be a similar thing. You know, when if you really need a wee and your bladder gets ready and it's just ready and all it, of course, that's the same with your digestive system. When it's ready, it's waiting, a latte is coming. What? A latte is not coming in. You can't bring your digestive system down from that, really.
I suppose it would be like queuing up at the student union bar when I was an undergraduate, where you have to, the normal thing was like waiting an hour to get served. And then you'd go, and I suppose the equivalent of them saying, oh, I'm sorry, we're out of beer, but we can do you a strawberry milkshake. It wouldn't be the same. But luckily, that never happened to my knowledge. The queuing up did, but not the rest of it. But Kate, do you want to say, so you mentioned obviously that you're in Whitley Bay. And see, when I think of you, I think of about five different things, because I think your talk, the brilliant talk, and it stayed with me. But I think of poetry. I think of northernness, because that was a big thing that you played on. Stand-up comedy. And I'm sure there's others as well. But because you did a PhD as well. I don't know if it was, Kent was part of that matrix. Is that right?
It was, yes, because when I did my PhD, I came to Kent several times because it's one of the few places that's a centre of comedy studies because of Ollie Double, who really is the originator of comedy studies in the UK, and the great conferences. I absolutely loved coming to Kent because the conferences were good, because I love the campus. Quite often I came when there were bluebells, loved the bluebells and squirrels. That's not on every campus, is it? I loved the journey. I liked Canterbury. Conference food, I have to say, that was not the best. No. So I did my PhD at the University of Leeds. Very good conference food. Some of the best brownies available anywhere would be at University of Leeds conferences. But anyway, so yes, I have very, very happy memories of Kent. And then also Kent is in my matrix because I came and did a couple of performances at the Autism and the Arts Festivals in Kent and connected with a lot of autistic performers who, like me, were adult women in their 40s, and they were all saying, Kit, you're autistic too. I was like, I kind of know I am, but I don't think I could get a diagnosis. And actually they said, well, come to Kent, the Tizard Centre has a brilliant adult diagnostic place. And I did. So there's actually, many roads have led to Kent for me.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. And of course, it's funny, and you see this on Facebook, when people know people who know people, and you think, how did that person who I went to school with 35 years ago, how can they be friends with somebody I work with in another department who actually I don't know really all that well? And you just sort of think the route there is fascinating. And somebody, people, probably, it's like that game that we used to play in the 90s when the internet was in its infancy. It was like 3 degrees of Kevin Bacon. Yeah. And you could always find everybody was connected somehow to somebody else. And so with you, it's the Tizard Centre. But actually, just one thing about food. I was at Leeds Trinity. It would have been at the end of 2019. And it was an all vegan and all vegetarian menu for the whole conference, except for breakfast. And I remember queuing up for breakfast. And the woman there, she said, it's not for me to get involved, she said, because obviously the conference organisers wanted it all vegan and vegetarian. But she said the number of people at the conference who queued up, especially early, like at 7 a.m, so they could get their sausage and bacon. And then the conference organisers like were not quite up at that point, so they wouldn't like admit it. It's like, the only meat you're going to get in the whole conference. I thought it was interesting. So I don't know whether that was a Leeds thing or a Leeds Trinity thing, but I was a associate going to Leeds with, and it was very nice, don't get me wrong, I thought it was a brilliant, you know, why not have an all vegetarian food, but it was a very unusual conference when everything on the table in front of you was, you know, completely meat free, and I thought, what an interesting way of doing it, rather than the other way around, everyone saying, you know, there isn't enough vegetarian food, so they overcompensated. I don't know if you've ever had an experience like that.
Oh, well, see, normally at conferences, and again, this now feels like the distant past, but so often the two or three plates that have been put aside are the veggie plates or the vegan plates look like the nicest plates. And you can see everyone looking enviously like, oh, they've got salad and tomatoes and we've just got beige sandwiches. So I can understand why that could, I bet that's going to happen more and more in future, isn't it? Although I also have a Leeds Trinity food memory because I did my postgraduate radio journalism diploma at Leeds Trinity, graduating in 98. So yeah, that was from 97 to 98. Always had lunch in the canteen, and it was a very kind of superior school dinner. Basically, there was always a crumble with custard. Happy days.
Yeah. Oh, Michael, those days. It's funny, isn't it? Because in later years, like I was just talking yesterday, it was Easter Sunday. And I don't know if anybody even has roast dinners anymore. But of course, these days, a meal out is like going to Starbucks and having a panini. Or maybe if you're really lucky, somewhere will give you a jacket potato. And I think, you know, I remember all those years ago when it was just like normal on a Sunday to have, you know, the question was, will it be beef, turkey or chicken this week? And I can't remember, apart from Christmas Day, I can't remember the last time that I had a roast dinner.
Oh, really? Oh, well, see, I can add one. I would add one yesterday. Me and my boyfriend are great aficionados of the Sunday roast. We have chicken, roast potatoes, Yorkshire puddings, the whole thing. But I do think, and I am sad to say this, a casualty of the pandemic is going to be the buffet and the carvery. I don't think we're going to see them come back. And this is sad. I love a breakfast buffet and a carvery. I do.
Do you know, it's so funny because the things that you just, we were talking about lattes, but the things you take for granted, I mean, how has it affected you in your work though? Because we both know Andy White, who has done some amazing, sort of like online variants of stand-up comedy, and we're hoping to get him to our next Lampeter reunion, although he was meant to go last year, and we have no idea what's happening this summer. But for you, has it completely like changed the way that you do everything? If you'd like press the reset button, and in some ways, is it like a sort of, not in a Tory party 90s back to basics way, but a different sort of like doing what you want to do, but in a refreshed way, rather than a sort of, I'm hating this pandemic and it's, you know, and it's driving me to despair sort of way?
Yes, mostly yes, actually. So the first few weeks were really difficult because there was that time where every email was, dear Kate, sorry, we'll be cancelling the thing, the other thing, the next thing, the festival, the gig, the blah. And then there was a little phase of, dear Kate, we're really optimistic and we're going to try and reschedule the gig, the festival. And at that point, I correctly was like, I don't think you are. I don't think that's going to happen. And I was right. For a little while, I was really not very interested in work anyway. And that was a reset because, you know, I'm pretty much a workaholic. I'm passionate about my creativity. I'm passionate about the shows that I make, the performances that I do, the workshops I run, all of it. And for, let's say, I'm going to say probably from the April to the November, I had basically no interest in promoting myself or anything that I did. And I did do some work in that time because I was lucky. Thank goodness, past Kate had set things up very well so that current apathetic Kate just got stuff to do. So I presented an episode of Radio 4's Pick of the Week from my living room on my phone in the May. I did a couple of projects with a photographer. I'm saying that like just our photographer, actually he's my boyfriend, but so we did a project together where we did he did photographs of his lockdown walks, I did poems, I was working towards my next poetry collection and I still had to write poems for that, so I managed to do some of that. I was supposed to be writing a play about an imagined encounter between Ted Hughes and Bernard Manning, and I managed to do some of that. And then a good thing happened. Oh, so, but I did say no to a lot of online performances. I didn't really have any interest. I just wanted, I either wanted to be in front of an audience or not doing anything. But then I started saying yes to things a little bit. from about September, and I have subsequently enjoyed some online creative writing workshops that I've run and gigs, but I have no particular urge to do proper stand-up in front of a Zoom audience. I recorded an episode of Sarah Millican's The Elephant in the Room show for Radio 4, and they had a brilliant setup where you could hear the audience laughter, and there was a chat box, and there was a really professional kind of tech setup. And that was that almost felt like doing a proper gig. However, still at the end of it, I then went back to I didn't go back to my flat. So I hadn't left my flat. I was in my flat with loads of adrenaline and nowhere to put it. And I don't like it. Like you, there's this untold story, I think. Sorry, Chris, this is also the longest answer in the world to your question. But there's an untold story about performers and their neurotransmitters in the last year. If you are a performer and you're a stand-up performer, you're probably at the very least addicted to adrenaline. And then all of a sudden, you kind of didn't get any. And that did weird things to you. I was speaking for most performers I know at that point. And then you might have weaned yourself off adrenaline, but then you started doing some online gigs. And they give you this massive shot of adrenaline, which your body goes, whoa, how do we process this? Not to mention the massive, this is, you know, neuropsychologically unsound, I think. I'm sure there's a slightly more sophisticated explanation, but there's also something like you probably had really background high levels of cortisol, the stress hormone, and then now that's doing something weird. Sorry to cut a long story short. I was really glad when a publisher asked me in the autumn if I would write a book of my show about Northern women. And from January till just last week when I submitted it, I mostly got my head down and wrote that and thought, thank God, I am not having to worry about the live work that I can't do. I'm not really having to worry about lockdown very much, because what I'm doing now is what I would have to do if I had to write this book anyway. Do you know what I mean? And it was the first time that I was thinking, wow, this is really normal. And since then, since I handed that book in, I am now back to that weird place of, oh, once again, my work is dependent on vaccines and audiences and apparently now vaccine passports and looking ahead to a future that's really difficult to imagine. And it's like, oh God. So I had this luxury, I think, for 3 months of writing a book. And I was in a very fortunate position when we came to the pandemic of having done a lot of different things in my working life, which meant that a lot of seeds I'd previously sown bore enough fruit that I didn't have to be the one very actively reaping them at that moment.
Yeah, I found in the autumn when we started teaching online, people were saying, oh, don't worry if you run out of things to say after 20 minutes, or if there's lots of ums and ahs and it's a bit unprofessional. We all know that. I actually found in the students found the opposite, that suddenly I was looking into the microphone, just like and the camera, which is the same thing, I guess, the webcam at the same time. And I suddenly thought, I'm actually enjoying this. And I was getting like really absurdly animated. Then I realized I was actually in my office doing one of these. And I was doing it in the evening, it was about 7 o'clock. And I thought, no one's going to interrupt me. And then the lady who does the cleaning was outside. And I know she wanted to come into the office, but she obviously thought, but he must be on his own in there because of COVID rules. But of course, I was a little bit too excited. And it felt like some sort of like weird stand-up type gig. And I was just like talking on something odd. It was modelled on death in the afterlife. And I was just like going completely carried away, and I couldn't stop it because then I didn't realise quite that I could press the pause button and go back to it. It was like the early days of Zoom teaching. And I was just aware of this presence, the Hoover outside, the knock on the door, and then the sort of, is he all right in there? Because he's talking about death rather a lot, but he seems to be really like really energised. And then afterwards I thought, this is the new normal. This is just the way it is. Looking in front of a camera. And of course, also one thing I found, I've got to admit, you're looking at yourself the whole time. And of course, I'm watching myself thinking, actually, you know, and suddenly imagining that this must be what it's like, you know, to do this well, you know this because you do radio and so on. But I'm actually thinking, I could get used to this. So when we were told that in the this autumn coming, we may have to continue teaching online because, you know, we don't quite know what's happening with the pandemic, I know the students kind of felt the same way. It's like, well, actually, we don't lose. If anything, we get as much time. Maybe we get more because we don't have to worry about somebody coming in after the hour or after the 2 hours, because the class is pre-recorded. So if you go a bit over, well, nobody minds. It's interesting, isn't it? That it's almost like the things we just take for granted are suddenly in a new light. We have the chance to change the things that we want to do and do it in a new format. And I don't know what we're going to go back to once one's life eventually is COVID-free.
No, but you're right. We've got the opportunity to change things because we had to change things. And in the future, the excuse of, oh, it's too hard to make gigs more accessible to more people or to do more online stuff, it's not going to fly, is it? That's brilliant. I look forward to this new hybrid world of online and in the flesh stuff. Yeah. There was a moment in a gig that I did the other week where I had let my guard down and said yes to doing it. And it was 15 minutes of a sort of poetry performance gig that was being hosted in Galway. I was going to say that. I still say the place where, so I'll be like, oh, I did a gig in Galway. I did a gig in Nottingham. Well, I didn't, did I? I did it in the cloud. I did it in the ether. It could have been anywhere, but I'm still determined to locate it. Yeah. Anyway, there was a thing about that I loved. So it was just on Zoom. Everybody was visible. Wasn't a webinar or anything like that. But they had the chat open and the audience were obviously used to posting in the chat during the performances. I loved being able to read what people were saying and to kind of incorporate their comments into my performance. And I did think this is kind of better than live. I would love to keep this element because for me, I find it easier to interpret verbal or written language than non-verbal or body language. So actually it was lovely to have that from an audience and it added something to the performance. So that was one thing that I thought I'd love to keep going. And there's so many accessibility issues. There are so many people who've come to gigs I've done and I've been to, not as many as I could have because I find it quite overwhelming, but I've gone to some gigs that I just wouldn't have been able to go to. And that's amazing, isn't it? We've apparently it was too hard to do it before, but yeah. It wasn't. We kind of instantly did it. We've got to keep it up. So there's also, I'm just saying this just because I haven't said this out loud before and we all haven't probably got to talk enough about our own personal obsessions recently. But I noticed, so in my field, which I suppose I see primarily as my field still of poetry and performance, there's quite a few older poets who have very much resisted the online world and being tech literate. And often I would say it's because they are in some way neurodivergent. And that is partly why the world of the performance poet who turns up and does 15 minutes at gigs is kind of has been perfect for them. It's quite a low-tech world. And they've been a bit excluded by the way that in recent years so much poetry has gone online. Suddenly, they have had to get on board with Zoom. Actually, to some extent, I am one of those poets. I'm not really, because actually I've done a lot of online stuff, but it's not my métier. I wasn't particularly excited by it. Now I've got the equipment, I've got the stuff, I've got what I need. I'm not going to be left behind. And I think that applies for an awful lot of slightly older creative people in all sorts of fields. Well, that's brilliant. We've finally all been swept along to where the millennials were already at.
Yeah, because that was something that really stood out. I mean, that word accessibility. And I think you were talking, weren't you, about when you came down to Kent about the whole thing about doing a PhD, doing a degree at a time when there was a lack of neurodiversity. There was a lack of understanding of the different cognitive ways of learning and teaching. And, you know, I mean, so many of my students now have disabilities, so many students, and we're prepared for it. In fact, it's become perfectly, quote, normal, if I can use that word, just to say, well, you know, don't worry, because we have resources in place, we're not going to let you fall behind. But I look back to when I was at university, and either people weren't didn't have disabilities, which of course we know is not the case, or they didn't go to university because there wasn't the opportunity, or the support networks weren't there. And I'm fascinated by this. I'd love to go back and just trying to work out, did people have mental health problems that they just couldn't talk about because of the stigmas attached? Or is this just something that in the last 5-10 years we've just become really attuned to? And I just don't know, because I know people my age who were at university decades ago, and they've got all sorts of health issues, which is, you know, exactly what, you know, unfortunately people have, but we didn't know about them at the time. And I'm finding that so interesting. I know we're about the same age, and there was something about being at university in the 90s. It felt wonderful, but there's obviously a lot going on behind the scenes that perhaps only now retrospectively we're starting to pick up on and realize that actually a lot of people may have missed the opportunity to flourish in those days.
Absolutely. No, I think that's spot on. And it's really, no, I'm fascinated by it too. And I think there is something about, so some neurodivergent people find a niche, are really good at finding the niches where they can flourish. And they do tend to be niches. And I think for me, one of them certainly that I found is the world of performance, be it stand-up or performance poetry, maybe performance poetry more than stand-up. And I think in education, that's the case. I mean, I didn't go to Cambridge or Oxford, but I suspect there would be certain parts of, say, Cambridge, where you would be better off if you were a certain type of neurodivergent than in other places, because it would be okay. You'd have your little study and you'd give all your students sherry and no one would mind. And you go, oh, I'm going to do my course this way because I just fancy it. And you could make things work for you. I suppose I'm talking there as if you were a lecturer, but that could apply for students too. Whereas certain types of students, that environment would be the worst thing that ever happened. They would not be able to thrive or flourish in it. But yeah, I can't help thinking an English degree at Cambridge could have gone either way for me. I was at Loughborough. I ended up, I did really well in the end because thankfully in the final, the weighting of my course marks was such that there was far more weight given to the final year and to my final year dissertation, which I had got really excited about because it was postmodernism. And I did an anti-social science fiction dissertation about dissertations. That was totally me. I was on board. So the first year, where if I was not excited by the course, I did very little and was getting, you know, 2-2s and thirds and things, that had been wiped out by the final year, where I got 84 for the dissertation and ended up with a first. So I was lucky. I was very lucky in the timing of everything there, because actually I could easily have just dropped out, I suppose, or, you know, not got a degree had things fallen a little bit differently.
Yeah, it's so important. And I say that to my students as well, because I think everybody, without even realizing it sometimes, has got some sort of skill or talent that is just waiting to be. It's like Dead Poet Society, isn't it? It's there. And sometimes, you know, the light bulb will go off and or on, whichever I mean. But sometimes it doesn't. And you always think, you know, it's the missed opportunity. I always say to the students, you know, you're not going to look back in 20 years' time and say, I wish I'd gone to fewer lectures, but you might say you wish you'd gone to more. But also it's the incumbent on us as tutors to make sure that it's worth everybody coming and feeling included. There's the number of students who would like happen to fall ill on the days when they're meant to give a presentation. And sometimes they might want to be teachers, but they're frightened of standing in front of a class of students. And so they do everything that they can, even arranging other meetings, almost comically. I remember one student went to every effort to even involve the career service and said, you know, I can only have a meeting at 2:00. You must give me a meeting at 2:00, which happened to be the very time of my lecture. And then, and it was just not so as not to stand in front of the class. And then 3 months later she said, can I write a reference for her, she wants to go into teaching. And I thought, this is interesting, you know. And I thought that, you know, what's going on in your mind in this, you know, is just fascinating. I don't know whether she went into teaching in the end, but it did feel as though in the 90s at university the norm was somebody would stand up and lecture for an hour or two And then you might ask questions. But if you didn't sort of follow what was said, you would just feel really stupid. If you, there was no opportunity to sort of have seminars in this, there were some of those, and some people would speak more loudly than others. But it was very much a case of you write an essay, and if you don't know, almost as if there's this like pre-existing essay that you just have to like know how to tap into, you wouldn't have study support sessions. You wouldn't have tutors who would be able to guide you. So something has changed significantly in the last few decades, and all for the good, but like you, I'm sort of wanting to go back and just trying to work out exactly how people managed in those days in a way that now it's just sort of like taken for granted that they will automatically be entitled to support as they must, because they've told us. If anything, now we want them to tell us that there's something that could be in stopping them from flourishing in their degree. Back then, the fear was that if they opened their mouth, they might be deemed to be, you know, ill-suited to doing the degree in the first place. So I'm often nostalgic about those days, but I'm not sure they were all that enlightening.
No, gosh, no. I mean, I'm just thinking, I would not have had the language or the vocabulary to in any way articulate what needs I might have, or even to suggest or have a clue how they might be met. Like, I had no idea. I mean, thinking back, I mean, it's one thing, isn't it, to have help and support available. The other part of that is that people are able to recognise what help and support they might need. And it does feel that now you have that more often anyway, that the double availability of that, the student has learned over the course of their school days what help and support they might need and how to ask it and how to access it. And of course that's still not perfect, and I'm sure there's a lot of people who feel they can't ask for the help and support, or they don't know what they need. Yeah. I would have thought a lot of them would be. So if you're dyslexic, that is more likely now to be picked up on, isn't it? That is a recognised neurodivergence, and it's visible. We can, you know, someone's having difficulty constructing language in some way, we can see that. I do think perhaps invisible things like autism and ADHD often still not picked up on, whereas mental health, more specifically mental health issues like depression and anxiety, again, more likely, I think, to be picked up on because we have external behaviours. So perhaps someone is not getting up, or they've got an eating disorder, or they're self-harming, or whatever it is. So perhaps there's still a kind of invisible conditions nexus where people are being missed.
Yeah, you just reminded me that at school there was always, I mean, what I would always call eccentricity, certainly, or traits that I certainly exhibit, people would laugh at. You know, there would always be that sense that if you weren't a cool person, who and there were a lot of people who just attached themselves to the cool people so that they themselves, in that sense, there was this protective wall. And if they were good at sports, great. But if you were if you were like me, somebody who was obsessed with the charts on a Sunday, and, you know, I didn't fit the obvious sort of paradigm, you know, you were just a bit odd. You know, you weren't sporty, therefore you didn't sort of like fit the obvious sort of rule. And it's just really interesting that these days, when I see students in class, and there might be students with all sorts of, and it may be ADHD or Tourette syndrome, for example, and everybody in the class just seems to sort of just, you know, they know what's happening and they're completely okay with it, because, and also it's a matter of making sure that it's a safe space for everybody. I don't think that was the case 30 years ago when I was at school. The way in which people would poke fun at somebody who didn't fit a certain standard or paradigm, it's just interesting looking back, and part of me is kind of keen to, because I've already reconnected with a lot of my university friends, but interesting to connect with some of those school friends and sort of see where I am now and where they are now, and just kind of see what sort of different paths we followed. But some of those people, you know, I don't think they were very nice people. Or maybe there was something that was being covered up, or it was about the culture of the time. Maybe they've got children now who may have the kind of traits that they were sort of keen to sort of, you know, spot and laugh at in other people. But something since the 80s, because I keep a diary and it's looking back on those days, and I think they were not actually, I'm nostalgic about my university days. I'm not nostalgic about my school days. So when you were at school and you went to university and you studied English, I mean, did you find that this was something, was it like a culture of expectation that you'd go to university, or was there a time when you just thought, you know, this cannot be the right pathway for me?
Okay, good question. And actually, although I said I would have studied English at Cambridge, what I actually studied at Loughborough was communication and media studies and a BSc. And that was partly in counter-reaction to the idea that maybe I should have applied to Oxbridge to do English, which was a scary idea. It was mooted by the school. I would have been one of very few students to do that. I think they'd had someone had gone to Oxford, and that was a big thing. And because I was noticeably bright, maybe I could have done that. But at the time, so I grew up in a family where I definitely, so my mum was, although she would have not been happy for anyone to say it, she was definitely working class, trained as a secretary, and then married my stepdad, and basically she ran the Steeplejacks business, which is a bit random. Steeplejacks, people who repair chimneys and spires. And my stepdad, who was a lot older than her, kind of just did bits and bobs for the company. So they were self-employed. He had been kind of middle class, but he was a bit of a middle class dropout from a sort of business family in Bradford. Anyway, so my stepdad sort of thought I should become a hotel manager because apparently that's what you, if you were a bright girl, you could manage a hotel. I can't think of anything personally that I would be less suited to doing in the world than running a hotel, but there we are. And my mum didn't, I don't think the future was a thing that she was very good at envisaging. So between them, they didn't think I should go to university at all. And I remember my stepdad saying, well, if you think, you know, so so I wanted to be a journalist. So you think you need to be could I go to university to be a journalist? You, well, prove it, you know, show me. So I had to write to various newspapers and to to Private Eye, which I read at the time. And I would say, how do you become a journalist? Because of course this was before the internet where I could just have gone, look, you have to go to university. Nowadays, you probably need a master's, never mind the degree. Anyway, and they all wrote back and said, well, here's the details of our graduate training schemes. Yes, you need to go to university. And Ian Hislop, I think, scribbled on the corner of my letter to Private Eye that what you needed was a quick mind, sense of humour, curiosity and a desire to stir things up. That's what he said he needed. So he didn't necessarily help me on you need a degree. But anyway, I've always remembered what he said you needed. And basically, to cut a long story short, sorry, I can go on. But he, I left my family, basically, just before the start of sixth form. I essentially ended up living in a bedsit on my own and doing my A-levels on my own, quite sensibly, just getting on with them, and was able to apply for a student grant just about, even though it was 1993 and they were phasing them out, on the basis that I was estranged from my family. And I basically took myself to university so that I could get there. But as I say, I was kind of aware dimly of this path that I could have gone down, probably, of being an Oxbridge student doing English, but as basically a working class girl living in a bedsit in Bradford, I couldn't quite get my head around it. I'd internalised a lot of inverted snobbery and a lot of fear and a lot of shame, and so it was easy just to not go there.
What I think is so empowering about what you have done is you've turned all that around, you've stared it in the face, and you've actually made that. Am I right in thinking that your PhD was actually on that very self-awareness? It was about perceptions of, like, you know, the things that you, the obstacles that you've had to face in your time, and actually almost like turning the mirror around the very sort of whole structures and edifice of what education can do, and bringing in issues of class, and that must be really empowering for you to do.
Yeah, very much. It was the PhD allowed me, actually, again, it's coming back to having the language and vocabulary to articulate this stuff that at some level you know, maybe your body knows it, but your mind has not quite worked out how this fits into the macro social structures and your micro internalized power stuff. And actually, because I chose in my PhD to look at stand-up performance as a type of resistance to classed and gendered and regionalised identities. So essentially I was looking at Northern English women like me and how stand-up can be a resistance. I was able to find thinkers like Pierre Bourdieu, lovely Bourdieu, who actually articulated all this class stuff that I didn't. So now I understood why I couldn't comfortably call myself working class. Of course I couldn't. It was the 90s. We weren't supposed to be working class anymore. We were Blair's children. We went to Waitrose. We're all middle class now. That's rubbish. Oh, what rubbish that was. But I, of course, believed it. You know, our class consciousness. I say our class consciousness. I suppose I'm talking about, kind of loads of people in the 90s, but working class women who had some slight elements of middle classness in their background, but not enough to actually be middle class. That was utterly erased. Of course it was erased. And of course there's a lot of shame underlying that. But I didn't, again, unarticulated, unknown. Was it a double whammy because I'm autistic and find it hard to articulate my emotions anyway? Would it have helped maybe if I'd been able to say, I can't apply to Cambridge, even though I have a bit of a desire to be a manic pixie dream girl in a spired turret somewhere reading John Donne? I can't do that because of my shame. I couldn't feel my shame or my anger or whatever it was. I had no idea. I just carried on doing my thing. In summary, to be able then to put this stuff in a context, multiple contexts. It wasn't just me. Hurrah! Very, very empowering. And I feel like I still haven't used that power to its fullest. I don't think it's for me, as in, I don't think I gained that power just for me. I must have done partly, of course. I feel more centred, more aware, more grounded. I have more agency. I have more self-knowledge. But actually, I think the reason for doing it has to be for other people in similar contexts to me to become part of that ecology of suddenly to sound very Marxist, if I could say, part of the class struggle and part of the neurodiversity struggle. Like, that's a responsibility now. Couldn't have done it without the PhD, though. As I keep saying, I had no vocabulary until then in which to do it.
Yeah, and it sounds to me then as though the stand-up comedy was a form of, it's very much part of the research process, because in doing that, you intertwine that, if that's even a word, with you know, you, so like the day job and the night job, or whichever one is comes first, become interlinked. I guess, I mean, I do this stuff on nostalgia, and it's interesting that, you know, beforehand I'd always think, you know, what do all the main theorists say? What do sociologists say about nostalgia? What do psychologists, anthropologists say? And I'd always look at the important people, as it were. And of course, in doing this podcast, I'm getting so much data from people who are not sort of showing off in terms of, you know, that they've found a new paradigm, or they've got this wonderfully published book. It's raw, authentic testimony, and it's so empowering for me, because suddenly I'm realizing that I've got a body of data that it's not a case of I found it on the shelves in the library. I've got it from talking to real people, and that's not something, much as I love my degree all those, and even my PhD all those years ago, that wasn't even part, you know, that it would have been unthinkable that I could even have had that sort of conversation with my supervisory team. So something has changed in the last few years for the better. But how have you found doing the stand-up, doing the research? Do you kind of feel you have to wear different hats, or do you feel it's the same hat and they're both just simply different sides of the same coin?
I think it's now the same hat. So I came up with the idea during my PhD of the stand-up scholar, because I didn't want to have to move into monologic authoritative mode in order to say what I needed to say, because to me one of the difficulties, one of the problems with that mode is that it leaves so much out and it leaves so many people out. So I didn't want to reproduce it. And I found this way of just, I mean, partly this way was to keep me interested, because I would have died of boredom if I wrote a PhD in one linear, in one voice and a linear PhD. So it had, in the end, I had this interrupting voice that would come in with jokes and quips and undercut what I said and undercut my argument. And, you know, it didn't undercut it so much that it said, this is complete bollocks, examiners, please fail me. It was quite a cunning, strategic voice in that way. It was a voice proving that perhaps, you know, like Mikhail Bakhtin would talk about the carnivalesque. You can have the carnivalesque in academia now, because we've recognised, I think, in academia that the body is a thing and knows things. And if the body knows things, or the body-mind knows things, we have to let that knowledge into our greater body of knowledge, otherwise it's not very good knowledge. And so for me, the fact that there were thinkers talking about this, be it feminist thinkers who I'd previously avoided, like Donna Haraway or Irigaray or Judith Butler, or whether it was sociologists like Bourdieu or, you know, literary theorists who've been saying this stuff for years, kind of like Bakhtin. Or handily, so this is the thing, comedy studies, what a brilliant discipline for me, because comedy studies is a discipline that is, by its very nature, not taken seriously, realistically, is it? You know, it kind of is. There are some scholars who've been able to make a niche in it, and Oliver Double is a brilliant example of that at Kent. But generally, it's not top of the list for AHRC funding or anybody's funding, and nobody thinks it's really important unless they're in it. But it's interdisciplinary. It has to be. And it has to take account of the body, because laughter is an absolutely crucial part of being able to look at comedy studies, although you can, you don't have to look at laughter, but it's quite important to comedy studies. So for me, comedy studies is this big countercultural voice in academia going, ha-ha, there's loads that you haven't thought about in academia, isn't there? Including your own desire for seriousness. What's that about, everybody? Although, of course, sometimes comedy studies is so desperate to be taken seriously, it can end up being written in that serious, monologic, authoritative voice. Yeah, I didn't have to do that in my PhD. And I kind of knew that when it came to picking an examiner, as long as we picked one who was going to be okay with that, which we did, job's a good one. So, and then how has it worked in stand-up? I just have this different awareness now when I'm doing my shows and writing. I have this awareness of the context in which I'm doing it in, the wider political context. I no longer question, is this a legitimate mode of resistance? Because I know it is. Joyousness is, laughter is, the duality of irony is, it's all okay. So I'm kind of more relaxed about what I'm doing, actually, and I love the mixture. I love being able to do both.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I remember as an undergraduate student, the idea that you'd bring in anything that wasn't academic or written academically into an academic discourse was just not countenanced. And so when I did film, I looked at film and religion for my PhD, and that at the time was seen to be something that was quite different, because you're bringing together two things that don't really, you know, there weren't that many, there were some, but there weren't that many books on the shelves in the library on theology and film. And now it's something that, you know, we teach in many universities all around the world. But in your case, what about things like, in my case, music? And radio played an unbelievably big part in my growing up. The charts on a Sunday, writing them down, sharing them in the playground. Did you have any sort of, or film maybe even, did you have similar sort of experiences that kind of defined you in conjunction with the academic studies that obviously you took very seriously in at university?
Such a good and hard question. Maybe the integration of my... Okay, so one name has come into my head, Leonard Cohen. So I discovered Leonard Cohen when I was 16 because my much older boyfriend was into him. And I kind of investigated further and I read Leonard Cohen's novels and I listened to all his music and I read biographies about him. And what I found was this figure who was going to be the perfect guide for me through a landscape in which it was going to be really important to question every statement and to keep the body involved in your knowledge. That's what he does. Leonard Cohen is, at the time that I was first discovering him, which was later than a lot of people did because he came to prominence in the early 70s, but I was only discovering him in the early 90s. At this point, he's a Zen Buddhist monk who goes up to the top of Mount Baldy near Los Angeles a couple of times a year, and does his Zen Buddhist thing and says things like, "It is not necessary to equip the word butterfly with small dusty wings in order for it to mean butterfly." And that was all I needed. Thanks, Leonard. That was all I needed to enter the world of literary theory and words are not things. Or words can be things. Words are things. Words do things, but they are not things. Anyway, so that him as a figure was vital. Everything else, oh, was a bit tangential, I think, in terms of film. Apart from that, tonally, I would happily. I took pride, I remember, at university in saying my two favourite films are Clueless and Schindler's List. Look, I'm a cultural omnivore, everyone. I mean, I wasn't, of course, I wasn't a cultural omnivore, actually. For example, I don't think I went to an independent cinema till I was in my early 30s. There was a lot of cultural experience that passed me by, I think, because of where I was. And I will partly say, quite literally, Bradford, Loughborough University, then a radio journalist in Newcastle. That narrowed down a lot of what I had access to. I did have, as well as Leonard Cohen, was just books generally, of course. All but and I maybe I was a cultural omnivore in terms of my reading. So yes, music and film. Yeah. So there was so much I didn't have.
It's interesting what you said about the cultural omnivore, because I was looking at film noir in my PhD, but I was also aware that that wasn't necessarily the type of film I would go and watch. And so I was kind of aware that there was the sort of stuff I needed to be writing about and the stuff that kind of I would. Although I suppose in lockdown, it's given me a chance to go back over all those sort of great sort of In the Line of Fire, The Fugitive, Basic Instinct, all that sort of early 90s stuff, which I think has really stood the test of time, even though in many cases they're all about male protagonists and how they're, and their virility and and Sharon Stone, who's got an autobiography out at the moment, is talks about how very unhappy she was at that scene in Basic Instinct. But just the things that we sort of just took for granted in those days, and it's interesting now, decades on, the people involved in those who are able to sort of give a different sort of insight into the sort of things that we just took for granted, because that was the stuff that was being churned out by Hollywood in those days. But would you say as well that the kind of things that really interest you and excite you, in addition, I mean, the radio journalism work I think is really interesting, because the pathway into that sounds as though it's really sort of idiosyncratic to you. That, how did you end up on radio? Was it, but obviously that there's the great performer side of you and the very very erudite side of you, but how did you end up channeling a lot of your interests into radio journalism?
I did after my degree, basically, after casting around and after becoming an entertainer for air tours in an all-inclusive hotel in Tunisia, which I do not recommend as a career path if you're an autistic woman. No, don't do it. I then came back and saw an advert for a radio journalism course at Trinity and All Saints in Leeds, which meant I could live with my stepmom and afford to do the course if I got a career development loan. And I just Having had the experience in Tunisia of having felt rootless and pointless, I was like, I need to do something that will lead somewhere. So I did this course for 9 months, which involved, well, there was this really crucial moment that I would love to have analysed in a Bourdieusian way. The radio tutor played us a BBC local radio bulletin and a commercial radio bulletin side by side. So, and the BBC local bulletin was 3 minutes of, well, the council has announced a new road, some bins have gone out, blah, 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 whatever. And the commercial radio bulletin with this exciting dynamic minute of the world, here's this happened. Angelina Jolie did this, then Israel exploded, boom. And I was like, oh, that's exciting. And I didn't consider, I didn't go, oh, I wonder which one will pay better or ultimately lead to greater cultural legitimacy or a future with a house I could afford. Because the answer to that obviously would have been BBC local radio would lead to cultural legitimacy, opportunities within the BBC, a good salary, security, lots and lots of things that I had no idea I was supposed to want or that were even things. I just went, oh, shiny bulletin for a minute. And then was one of the few journalists on the course who actively wanted a job in commercial local radio, which I secured. And not completely easily, because I had a northern accent, which even when you want to work on northern radio stations, it's not an asset. So it required a bit of accepting work at a not very good, at a very small startup local station eventually, Rutland Radio, which interestingly has now started again after a gap and is now an online station. Anyway, I did, and I loved being a radio reporter and a newsreader on commercial radio, despite the fact that programme directors often didn't want my voice on the radio, so I would have to do reports rather than be a newsreader. And eventually I got to work for a station in the Northeast that would let me be a newsreader. But actually, that was not my path to Radio 4, funnily enough. My path to Radio 4 was then leaving that work, writing poetry, running poetry workshops, entering performance poetry competitions, doing quite well, getting spotted by the comedy commissioner of Radio 4 at the time, Caroline Raphael, to be a regular poet on Saturday Live on Radio 4. Clearly, they were going, a northern female voice. I think we might need that with our four middle-class white blokes that we've currently got being poets. That then was a completely different entry into national radio. So I got into national radio because of the unacceptable factors that meant it was hard to get into commercial local radio.
It's interesting, isn't it? That idea sometimes of not playing by the rules or not being able to play by the rules because you're not a white man. And yet actually suddenly there was an awareness that this, you know, the way things were couldn't carry on. And that opened up floodgates. Because in my case, I've always been interested that, you know, people would always say to me at university, we don't know where you're from because you don't seem to have an accent. And I'm actually from Cardiff. And I think, and I don't know, this is probably, I mean, maybe ask my parents, I don't know, but I used to listen to so much radio growing up, and I used to sort of like emulate them. I used to listen, and everyone sounded very posh in those days, in the 80s. All the Radio 1 DJs all sounded terribly posh in public school. And I kind of thought, I want to sound like them. I want to be like them. And I'm sure there must be more to it than that, because I was perfectly sociable. I mean, it's not like I sort of, you know, lived in this ivory tower and never went out. But whenever I went back to my hometown, I was aware that people had Cardiff accents and I didn't. Because when everyone sounds the same, you don't notice it. It's only, you know, having gone away and come back. So it is interesting that there is. So maybe like 30 years ago when I was at school, I probably like had the right voice to go on radio. And now here I am. I'm like, but Chris, you've got this like radio voice of 30 years ago, but you don't do anything in radio. So I kind of feel that I'm a walking contradiction.
Although I would think, then, for what it's worth, my perception would be you probably do have a neutral voice. It's not a posh voice, is it? It's not attempting to be RP. And I think there's a really interesting, I've just written about both Joan Bakewell and Jenny Murray as Northern women for my Northern Women book. And the journeys of their voice. So basically, Joan Bakewell had to fashion her own RP voice out of a Stockport accent. in order to leave Stockport, and eventually I believe she went to Cambridge. Now, she fashioned it herself. She didn't have elocution lessons. And what she ended up with is a posher voice than, say, Jenny Murray from Barnsley, who had elocution lessons and ended up with a much more neutral voice. Joan Bakewell is now told, or has discovered in her 80s, that she doesn't get as much radio and telework because she's perceived as too posh. Jenny Murray, although she's just left Woman's Hour, essentially is more neutral voiced and is less likely to be rejected for that poshness. But I just find that absolutely fascinating that you the decisions that you made or were made for you, vocal decisions many years before, then live on. I mean, well, you're finding it. As I say, I think you would still stand now as having a perfect neutral radio voice that stands you in better stead, to be fair, than a Cardiff accent would have done.
Do you know, I was talking to a linguist actually at Kent who suddenly said to me, but you don't sound like not a real person, but it's like, but I can't, she did this study of accents and actually said, but there's something about you, I don't get nothing about your past sort of fits. And I thought, no, this is my voice. I'm not this, you know, I've never created a voice. And if you listen to me all those years ago, apart from when I was really young, then, you know, I sounded like this. But that's interesting about Joan Bakewell, because I would never have thought she was from the north of England, but she sounds as plum and as posh. I would have just, if you'd asked me, I would have said definitely home counties. Surrey, I would have probably guessed. So how interesting that she felt this need. And obviously it did her very, you know, hard of the matter in the 80s and 90s, but you're right, there may have come a point then suddenly when that was no longer in vogue, and so your book is it all about that, sort of about accents and northernness and broadcasting kind of, you know, roots into what is acceptable and not acceptable in terms of like social and media circles?
No, although I kept getting distracted by issues like that, because I continue to be fascinated by performance and how we react to performance and how we create them. But it's about northern women. I did a show that was quite a mainstream sort of show called Where There's Muck, There's Bras, about northern women. And essentially it's northern women through history, and then but also northern women, contemporary ones who I think we should remember. It was originally a commission for the Great Exhibition of the North, which was interesting in its genesis. Basically, George Osborne and the Northern Powerhouse Initiative led to this festival in the Northeast, which is not traditionally taken as the North. It's not allowed to speak for the North, but it did with this festival. And I cannily timed it so that I got a commission, essentially, in order to explore some of my PhD stuff around why northern women are less likely to be heard and how they can resist that. And of course, people, you know, nostalgia, people are very nostalgic for the idea of a strong northern woman like Betty Boothroyd, the Speaker of the House of Commons, or Beryl Burton, the cyclist, or Barbara Castle, another politician, or Hilda Ogden from Coronation Street. So I've tapped into that vein, but at the same time, I kind of want to undercut it and question it. So the book, as I say, it's quite mainstream. It's funny, but it's also attempting to say, why do we constantly forget our northern women, basically? So I wrote about Joan Bakewell and Jenny Murray in a section about radio women, which also included Sarah Cox and Liz Kershaw, who, of course, have their radio gigs because of their northern accents, which they would not have felt required to lose.
Yeah, no, I remember reading Liz Kershaw's autobiography a few years ago, and it's fascinating about the day. And of course, her brother as well, who they have this, like, at one point, brother and sister on, they were like the Ed and David Milibands of Radio 1 in those days, of siblings on, you know, who were both sort of high flyers at one point in the late 80s. But just thinking, just a couple more questions as we start to wrap up. Okay, would you ever have imagined, you know, your younger self doing what you're doing now? I guess that, you know, it's that whole sense of having a conversation between the present, you know, who you are now and who you were then. What advice would you give your younger self? What would your younger self have thought about what you ended up doing today?
I think my younger self would have been really chuffed, actually, because I did want to be seen and heard because that was the thing I was told I couldn't be or shouldn't be while I was growing up in my family. And I feel I am seen and heard now, so that is great. I wanted to be independent. I wanted to be able to, probably, although I hadn't even heard of them, I wanted to be able to go and get lattes by the seaside and then swim in the sea. And I could do that every day if I want, pretty much now. And I wanted I knew I wanted varied work, and I wanted people to come to me with interesting things for me to do and offer them to me. And that has finally started happening. And it's interesting that I didn't want to. So that doesn't sound very self-directed, does it? But maybe I knew that I couldn't quite imagine what was possible, because my range of knowledge of what was possible was quite limited. And I wanted it to be expanded, and that has happened. So I am just, and you know, I used to, at university, I'd have these mad ideas for shows that I could do that actually, had I been in a different context and had a vocabulary for what I wanted to do and how I could have done it, maybe if I'd been on a theatre course or a performance course, I could have done this stuff, but I just didn't know how to make it happen. And I now feel like if I have an idea, I'm far more likely to be able to know how to make it happen. So there's all this knowledge I've picked up, and it's useful knowledge. And I didn't know I didn't have it before. That was the other thing. It wasn't like I could go, oh, if I will search this knowledge out and then I would be fine. I didn't know I needed it. That's why Bourdieu was such a revelation to me. He made me understand that, yes, lots of us don't, we grow up not knowing what we don't know because we don't know it.
And you see yourself as a trailblazer, because it, just listening to you, you're so inspiring. There must be people who, well, hopefully, even whether, you know, not necessarily this podcast, but who know you and just think, I can do that, because, you know, 20 years ago, you weren't out there saying the things that you're saying now.
Actually, yeah, I would love to see myself as a trailblazer. I don't. But one of the things I most like is when people do get in touch because of something I've done. And it does seem to be a variety of things. It might be because I ran a creative writing workshop, or I ran a gig and it was their first gig, or they saw me talk about autism, or they saw me do my Northern Women show, or they saw me going on again about poor pay for poets. And they will say, oh, that made me think this or do this. And I'll be like, yay. Oh, that's brilliant then, because often whatever the thing was, I hadn't known about the thing 10, 15, 20 years ago. And clearly, yes, as you say, maybe that means that I kind of inspired other people to do or know the stuff I didn't know. That is something that would make me very happy.
I'm quite sure that you're very good at galvanizing an audience. And I think there's something very natural, very authentic. And I think that's the thing. Somebody the other day was maybe in a political biography, I can't remember where I read it, but he was just saying that as long as people recognize that the person on the stage is trying their hardest to connect and is like being real and is not condescending, then actually they'll be given a lot of slack. It's when the person comes on, I've seen comedians actually when I was at Lampeter who would sometimes come on, and the first thing they did was talk about students being lazy, and of course the students then started like throwing things, both verbally and probably physically, and they walked off in a huff. And I was like, you know, even I would know that you wouldn't do that. It'd be like me going to my students saying you're all terrible. I wouldn't think it anyway, but if I did it, you know, I suspect I wouldn't get much respect.
No, exactly. Although I have to say, I am also, because I do question things, I get some leeway because of my Northern accent and my Northernness, and people go, oh, that's lovely. Oh, she's very authentic, very warm, lovely. Be suspicious of that though. Like, I think maybe I am, but in politics, if we look at certain politicians like Jess Phillips or Angela Rayner, they are brilliant at mobilising. I'm one of you. I'm an ordinary person. Neither of them are. They're not. Jess Phillips is far more to the right of her party than Angela Rayner is. And yet they are both able to mobilise as if they are in pretty much the same position of ordinary womanness. The minute you step over that threshold into the House of Commons, you're not there. You're not in that place of ordinary womanness, but you can do a brilliant performance of it, and they both do. And I think I'm also very fascinated by that. I am a poet. I'm a poet. I'm an academic. I'm an ethnographer sometimes, if I go on about it enough. None of those things feel accessible to most of the sort of people I love to reach. And so one way of Trojan horsing all that stuff is to maintain, not that I would lose it, how would I lose it now anyway, but to maintain the Northern accent and my natural way of being and connecting. Because otherwise, there are lots of things about me. Oh, and being autistic. Lots of things about me that are quite alienating, weird, and don't connect with people. And yet somehow I do, because I really want to connect with people. And I have this, I haven't lost my natural manner, if you like.
It sounds like you've harnessed it. It sounds like what you've done, taken something that maybe once upon a time you'd have to say, oh no, I'm not going to get work because people will hear me or see me and think I don't fit a certain template. And now you can say that template is broken, and you've proven that it's broken. That must be quite gratifying in some ways.
I would like to smash a few more ceilings and enter a few more spaces where I'm not supposed to be, but for now this is okay. I'm doing okay at that. Yes.
Yeah, well, I've got one more question. It's the question I always ask at the end of my interviews, Kate. Are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I want to be a looking forward person, but I've noticed during this interview in a few questions I've mentioned either times where I was not able to see the future, and I noticed that I mentioned about my mum not being able to see the future, and certainly at the start of the pandemic I couldn't see the future. So there's so much about my energy and my being that is all about forwardness, and I would love if the North could be more associated with the future rather than the past. And that's a balance I've tried to strike in my book, where I talk a lot about the future as well as the past. But realistically, given the limitations of myself, being and context, I'm a looking back sort of girl very much. And my boyfriend takes the mickey out of me, because if I make a joke, the reference that I will first reach for, it's an 80s reference. If I wanted to make a joke about someone being bald, as in lacking hair, it's Duncan Goodhue that I'm reaching for. If I want to talk about, I'll try to think of another example, but it works for pretty much anything. Someone who is irritating. I'll be like, as irritating as Bonnie Langford. Hang on, Bonnie Langford hasn't been irritating for decades. But and part of me is totally stuck in the 80s, and I'm quite interested in that. But there we are. That's where I am.
Well, Kate, it has been such a joy to catch up with you. Thank you for being my guest this week.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Chris. Go and have some lattes now.